You keep your eye on Venus, and don't let the Martian situation get out of control. Yes, sir, she said. Everything's going to be fine. And looking at the dead screen where her superior had been, Avasarala decided that maybe he even thought it was true. Avasarala wasn't sure any longer. Something was bothering her, and she didn't yet know what it was. It only lurked there, just underneath her conscious mind, like a splinter in a fingertip. She opened the captured video from the UN outpost on Ganymede, went through the mandatory security check, and watched the Marines die again. Kiki and Suri were going to grow up in a world where this had happened, where Venus had always been the colony of something utterly foreign, uncommunicative, and implacable. The fear that carried would be normal to them, something they didn't think about any more than they did their own breath. On her screen, a man no older than Soren emptied an assault rifle clip into the attacker. The enhanced images showed the dozens of impacts cutting through the thing, the trails of filament coming out its back like streamers. The soldier died again. At least it had been quick for him. She paused the image. Her fingertip traced the outline of the attacker. "Who are you?" she asked the screen. "What do you want?" She was missing something. It happened often enough that she knew the feeling, but that didn't help. It would come when it came. All she could do until it did was keep scratching where it itched. She shut down the files, waiting for the security protocols to make sure she hadn't copied anything, then signed out and turned to the window. She found that she was thinking about the next time, what information they'd be able to get the next time, what kind of pattern she'd be able to glean from the next time, the next attack, the next slaughter. It was already perfectly clear in her mind that what had happened on Ganymede was going to happen again, sooner or later. Genies didn't get put back into bottles. And from the moment the protomolecule had been set loose on the civilian population of Eros just to see what it would do, civilization had changed. Changed so fast and so powerfully that they were still playing catch-up. Playing catch-up. There was something there. Something in the words, like a lyric from a song she almost remembered. She ground her teeth and stood up, pacing the length of her window. She hated this part. Hated it. Her office door opened. When she turned to look at Soren, he flinched back. Avasarala took her scowl down a couple of notches. It wasn't fair to scare the poor bunny. He was probably just the intern who'd pulled the short straw and gotten stuck with the cranky old woman. And, in a way, she liked him. "Yes," she said. "I thought you'd want to know that Admiral Nguyen sent a note of protest to Mr. Ehrenreich. Interference in his field of command. He didn't copy the Secretary General." Avasarala smiled. If she couldn't unlock all the mysteries of the universe, she could at least keep the boys in line. And if he wasn't appealing to the bobblehead, then it was just pouting. Nothing was going to come from it. "Good to know. And the Martians?" "They're here, ma'am." She sighed, plucked at her sari and lifted her chin. "Let's go stop the war, then," she said. Chapter 13. Holden. Amos, who'd finally turned up a few hours after the food riot, carrying a case of beer and saying he'd done some recon, was now carrying a small case of canned food. The label claimed it was chicken food products. Holden hoped that the hacker Prax was leading them to would see the offering as at least being in the spirit of his requested payment. Prax led the way with the manic speed of someone who had one last thing to do before he died and could feel the end close on his heels. Holden suspected this wasn't far from the truth. The small botanist certainly looked like he'd been burning himself up. They'd taken him aboard the somnambulist while they'd gathered the supplies they'd need, and Holden had forced the man to eat a meal and take a shower. Prax had begun stripping while Holden was still showing him how to use the ship's head, as if waiting for privacy would waste precious time. The sight of the man's ravaged body had shocked him. All the while, the botanist spoke only of May, of his need to find her. Holden realized that he'd never in his life needed anything as badly as this man needed to see his daughter again. To his surprise, it made him sad. Prax had been robbed of everything, had all his fat boiled away. He'd been rendered down to the bare minimum of humanity. All he had left was his need to find his little girl, and Holden envied him for it. When Holden had been dying and trapped in the hell of Eros Station, he had discovered that he needed to see Naomi one last time. Or, barring that, to see that she was safe. It was why he hadn't died there. That and having Miller at his side with a second gun. And that connection, even now that he and Naomi were lovers, was a pale shadow compared to the thing driving Prax. It left Holden feeling like he'd lost something important without realizing it. While Prax had showered, Holden had gone up the ladder to Ops, where Naomi had been working to hack her way into Ganymede's crippled security system, pulled her out of her chair, and held her for a few moments. She stiffened with surprise for a second, then relaxed into his embrace. "Hi," she whispered in his ear. It might be a pale shadow, but it was what he had right now, and it was pretty damn good. Prax paused at an intersection, his hands tapping at his thighs as if he were hurrying himself along. Naomi was back on the ship, monitoring their progress through locators they all carried, and with the remnants of the station security cameras. At Holden's back, Amos cleared his throat and said in a voice low enough that Prax wouldn't hear, "If we lose this guy, I don't like our chances of finding our way back too quick." Holden nodded. Amos was right. Even at the best of times, Ganymede was a maze of identical gray corridors and occasional park-like caverns, and the station certainly wasn't at her best now. Most of the public information kiosks were dark, malfunctioning, or outright destroyed. The PubNet was unreliable at best, and the local citizens moved like scavengers over the corpse of their once great moon, alternately terrified and threatening. He and Amos were both openly wearing firearms, and Amos had mastered a sort of constant glower that made people automatically put him onto their not-to-be-fucked-with list. Not for the first time, Holden wondered what sort of life Amos had been leading prior to his signing up for a tour on the Canterbury, the old water hauler they'd served together on. Prax came to a sudden halt in front of a door that looked like 100 other doors they'd already passed, set into a wall of a gray corridor that looked like every other gray corridor. "This is it. He's in here." Before Holden could respond, Prax was hammering on the door. Holden took a step back and to the side, giving himself a clear view of the doorway past Prax. Amos stepped to the other side, tucking the case of chicken under his left arm and hooking his right thumb into his waistband just in front of the holster. A year of patrolling the belt, cleaning up the worst jackals that the governmental vacuum had left behind, had instilled some automatic habits in his crew. Holden appreciated them, but he wasn't sure he liked them. Working security certainly hadn't made Miller's life any better. The door was yanked open by a scrawny and shirtless teenager with a big knife in his other hand. "The fuck?" he started, then stopped when he saw Holden and Amos flanking Prax. He glanced at their guns and said, "Oh, I've brought you chicken," Prax replied, pointing back at the case Amos carried. "I need to see the rest of the camera footage." "Could have got that for you," Naomi said in Holden's ear, given enough time. "It's the enough time part that's a problem," Holden sub-vocalized back at her. "But that's definitely plan B." The skinny teen shrugged and opened the door the rest of the way, gesturing for Prax to enter. Holden followed, with Amos bringing up the rear. "So," the kid said, "show it, sabe?" Amos put down the case on a filthy table and removed a single can from the box. He held it up where the kid could see it. "Sauce?" the kid said. "How about a second can instead?" Holden replied, moving over to the kid and smiling up at him agreeably. "So, go get the rest of the footage and we'll get out of your hair. Sound good?" The kid lifted his chin and pushed Holden an arm's length back. "Don't push up on me, macho." "My apologies," Holden said, his smile never wavering. "Now go get the damn video footage you promised my friend here." "Maybe no," the kid said. He flapped one hand at Holden. "Adinerado, si no? Quizás you got more than chicken to pay. Maybe a lot." "Let me get this straight," Holden replied. "Are you shaking us down? Because that would be..." A meaty hand came down on his shoulder, cutting him off. "I got this one, Cap," Amos said, stepping between Holden and the kid. He held one of the chicken cans in his hand, and he was tossing it lightly and catching it. "That guy," Amos said, pointing at Prax with his left hand while continuing to toss the chicken with his right, "got his baby girl snatched. He just wants to know where she is. He's willing to pay the agreed-upon price for that information." The kid shrugged and started to speak, but Amos held up a finger to his lips and shushed him. "And now, when that price is ready to be paid," Amos said, his tone friendly and conversational, "you want to shake him down, because you know he's desperate. He'll give anything to get his girl back. This is a fat payday, right?" The kid shrugged again. "Que no?" Amos smashed the can of chicken food product into the kid's face so fast that for a moment Holden couldn't figure out why the hacker was suddenly lying on the ground, blood gushing from his nose. Amos settled one knee onto his chest, pinning him to the floor. The can of chicken went up and then pistoned down into the kid's face again with a sharp crack. He started to howl, but Amos clamped his left hand over the boy's mouth. "You piece of shit," Amos yelled, all the friendliness gone from his voice, leaving just a ragged animal rage that Holden had never heard there before. "You gonna hold a baby girl hostage for more fucking chicken?" Amos smashed the can into the hacker's ear, which immediately bloomed red. His hand came away from the kid's mouth, and the boy started yelling for help. Amos raised the can of chicken one more time, but Holden grabbed his arm and pulled him up off the gibbering kid. "Enough," he said, holding on to Amos and hoping the big man didn't decide to clobber him with the can instead. Amos had always been the kind of guy who got into bar fights because he enjoyed them. This was something different. "Enough," Holden said again, and then held on until Amos stopped struggling. "He can't help us if you bash his brains out." The kid scooted backward across the floor and had his shoulders up against the wall. He nodded as Holden spoke and held his bleeding nose between his finger and thumb.
That right? Amos said. You going to help?
The kid nodded again and scrambled to his feet, still pressed against the wall.
I'll go with him, Holden said, patting Amos on the shoulder. Why don't you stay here and take a breather?
Before Amos could answer, Holden pointed at the terrified hacker.
Better get to work.
There, Prax said when the video of May's abduction came up again. That's May. That man is her doctor, Dr. Strickland. That woman, I don't know her, but May's teacher said that she came up in their records as May's mother, with a picture and authorization to pick her up. Security is very good at the school. They'd never let a child go without that.
Find where they went, Holden said to the hacker. To Prax, he said, why her doctor?
May is... Prax started, then stopped and started over. May has a rare genetic disease that disables her immune system without regular treatments. Dr. Strickland knows this. 16 other kids with her disorder are missing too. He could keep May alive.
You getting this, Naomi?
Yep, riding the hacker's trail through security. We won't need him again.
Good, Holden said, because I'm pretty sure this bridge is thoroughly burned once we walk out the door.
We always have more chicken, Naomi said with a chuckle.
Amos made sure the kid's next request will be for plastic surgery.
Ouch, she replied.
He okay?
Holden knew she meant Amos.
Yeah, but is there something I don't know about him that would make this problematic? Because he's really...
Aki, the hacker said, pointing at his screen. Holden watched as Dr. Strickland carried May down an older-looking corridor, the dark-haired woman in tow. They came to a door that looked like an ancient pressure hatch. Strickland did something at the panel next to it, and the three of them went inside.
No eyes past this, the hacker said,
almost flinching as if in expectation of being punished for the failings of the Ganymede security system.
Naomi, where does that go?
Holden said, patting the air to let the hacker know he wasn't to blame.
Looks like an old part of the original dig, she said, her words punctuated by pauses as she worked her console. Zoned for utility storage. Shouldn't be anything beyond that door but dust and ice.
Can you get us there? Holden asked. Naomi and Prax both said yes at the same time.
Then that's where we're going.
He gestured for Prax and the hacker to lead the way back out to the front room, then followed them. Amos was sitting at the table, spinning one of the chicken cans on its edge like a thick coin. In the light gravity of the moon, it seemed like it would keep spinning forever. His expression was distant and unreadable.
You did the job,
Holden said to the hacker, who was staring at Amos, his face twitching from fear to rage and back again.
So you'll get paid. We aren't going to stiff you.
Before the kid could reply, Amos stood up and picked up the case of canned chicken. He turned it over and dumped all the remaining cans on the floor, where a few rolled away to various corners of the small room.
Keep the change, asshole, he said, then threw the empty box into the tiny kitchen nook.
And with that, Holden said, we'll take our leave. After Amos and Prax had gone out the door, Holden backed out, keeping a watchful eye on the hacker to make sure there were no misguided attempts at revenge. He shouldn't have worried. The minute Amos was out the door, the kid just started picking up the chicken cans and stacking them on the table. As he backed out and closed the door behind him, Naomi said, "You know what it means, don't you?"
"Which thing?" he replied, then said to Amos,
Back to the ship.
Prax said all the kids with May's particular disorder were missing, Naomi continued, and her doctor is the one who took her out of school.
So we can probably assume he, or people working with him, took the others, Holden agreed.
Amos and Prax were walking together up the corridor, the big man still wearing his distant look. Prax put a hand on his arm, and Holden heard him whisper, "Thank you." Amos just shrugged.
"Why would he want those kids?" Naomi asked.
"The better question to me is, how did he know to take them just hours before the shooting started?"
"Yeah," Naomi said, her voice quiet. "Yeah. How did he know that?"
"Because he's the reason why things went pear-shaped," Holden replied, saying out loud what they were both thinking.
"If he's got all of those kids, and he or the people he's with were able to start a shooting war between Mars and Earth to cover up the snatch,
starts to feel like a strategy we've seen before, doesn't it? We need to know what's on the other side of that door."
"One of two things," Naomi said. "Nothing, because after the snatch, they got the hell off this moon.
Or," Holden continued, "a whole lot of guys with guns."
"Yeah." The galley of the Somnambulist was quiet as Prax and Holden's crew watched the video again. Naomi had pieced together all the security footage of May's abduction into a single long loop. They watched as her doctor carried her through various corridors, up a lift, and finally to the door of the abandoned parts of the station. After the third viewing, Holden gestured for Naomi to turn it off.
"What do we know?" he said, his fingers drumming on the table. "The kid's not scared. She's not fighting to get away," Amos said.
"She's known Dr. Strickland all her life," Prax replied. "He would be almost like family to her."
"Which means they bought him," Naomi said. "Or this plan has been going on for
4 years, Prax said.
4 years, Naomi repeated.
"Which is a hell of a long con to run, unless the stakes are huge.
Is it kidnapping?
If they want a ransom payment,
doesn't wash.
A couple hours after May disappears into that hatch," Holden said, pointing at the image frozen on Naomi's screen, "Earth and Mars are shooting each other. Somebody's going to a lot of trouble to grab 16 sick kids and hide the fact they did it."
"If Protogen wasn't toast," Amos said, "I'd say this is exactly the kind of shit they'd pull.
And whoever it is has significant tech resources too," Naomi said. "They were able to hack the school system even before the Ganymede NetSec was collapsing from the battle, and insert that woman's records into May's file without any trace of tampering. Some of the kids in her school had very rich or powerful parents," Prax said. "Their security would have to be top-notch." Holden drummed out a last rhythm on the tabletop with both hands, then said,
"Which all leads us back to the big question. What's waiting for us on the other side of that door?"
"Corporate goons," Amos said.
"Nothing," Naomi said.
"May,"
Prax said quietly.
"It might be May."
"We need to be prepared for all three possibilities. Violence, gathering clues, or rescuing a kid. So, let's put together a plan. Naomi, I want a terminal with a radio link that I can plug into whatever network we find on the other side and give you a doorway in."
"Yep," Naomi said, already getting up from the table and heading toward the keel ladder.
"Prax, you need to come up with a way for May to trust us if we find her and give us details on any complications her illness might cause during a rescue. How quickly do we need to get her back here for her meds? Things like that."
"Okay," Prax said, pulling out his terminal and making notes. "Amos?"
"Yeah, Cap,"
That leaves violence to us. Let's tool up. The smile began and ended at the corners of Amos's eyes. Fuck yeah. Chapter 14. Prax. Prax didn't understand how near he was to collapse until he ate. Canned chicken with some kind of spicy chutney, soft, no-crumb crackers of the type usually used in zero-G environments, a tall glass of beer. He wolfed it down, his body suddenly ravenous and unstoppable. After he finished vomiting, the woman who seemed to take care of all the small practical matters on the ship, he knew her name was Naomi, but he kept wanting to call her Cassandra, because she looked like an intern by that name he'd worked with 3 years earlier, switched him to a thin protein broth that his atrophied gut could actually handle. Over the course of hours, his mind started coming back. It felt like waking up over and over without falling asleep in between. Sitting in the hold of Holden's ship, he'd find himself noticing the shift in his cognition, how much more clearly he could think, and how good it felt to come back to himself. And then, a few minutes later, some set of sugar-deprived ganglia would struggle back to function, and it would all happen again. And with every step back toward real consciousness, he felt the drive growing, pushing him toward the door that Strickland and May had gone through. "Doctor, huh?" the big one, Amos said. "I got my degree here. The university's really good. Lots of grant money. Or, now I suppose there used to be."
"I was never much for formal education myself."
The relief ship's mess hall was tiny and scarred by age. The woven carbon filament walls had cracks in the enameling, and the tabletop was pitted from years, maybe decades of use. The lighting was a thin spectrum shifted toward pink that would have killed any plants living under it in about 3 days. Amos had a canvas sack filled with formed plastic boxes of different sizes, each of which seemed to have a firearm of some kind inside. He had unrolled a square of red felt and disassembled a huge matte black pistol on it. The delicate metal parts looked like sculpture. Amos dipped a cotton swab into a bright blue cleaning solution and rubbed it gently on a silver mechanism attached to a black metal tube, polishing metal plates that were already bright as a mirror. Prax found his hands moving toward the disassembled pieces, willing them to come together, to be already cleaned and polished and remade. Amos pretended not to notice, in a way that meant he was very much aware. "I don't know why they would have taken her," Prax said. "Dr. Strickland has always been great with her. He'd never hurt her. I don't think he'd hurt her."
"Yeah, probably not," Amos said.
He dipped the swab into the cleaning fluid again and started on a metal rod with a spring wrapped around it.
"I really need to get there," Prax said. He didn't say, "Every minute here is a minute that they could be hurting May, that she could be dying or getting shipped off world."
He tried to keep his words from sounding like a whine or a demand, but they seemed to come out as both.
"Getting ready's the shitty part," Amos said, as if agreeing to something. "You want to get right out into it right the fuck now. Get it over with."
"Well, yes," Prax said.
"I get that," Amos said. "It's no fun, but you've got to get through it. Going in without your gear ready, you might as well not go. Plus which, the girl's been gone for how long now?"
"Since the fighting. Since the mirror came down."
"Chances of another hour making much difference are pretty small, right?"
"But..."
"Yeah," Amos said with a sigh. "I know. This is the tough part. Not as bad as waiting for us to get back, though. That's gonna suck even worse."
Amos put down the swab and started fitting the long black spring back over the spindle of bright metal. The alcohol fumes of the cleaning solution stung Prax's eyes.
"I'm waiting for you," Prax said.
"Yeah, I know," Amos said, "and I'll make sure we're real quick about it. The captain's a real good guy, but he can get kind of distracted sometimes. I'll keep him on point. No trouble."
"No," Prax said. "I don't mean I'm waiting for you when you go to that door. I mean I'm waiting for you right now. I'm waiting to go there with you."
Amos slid the spring and spindle into the shell of the gun, twisting it gently with his fingertips. Prax didn't know when he'd risen to his feet.
"How many gunfights have you been in?"
Amos asked. His voice was low and wide and gentle.
"Because I've been in... shit. This'll be 11 for me. Maybe 12 if you count the one time when the guy got up again as a different fight. Point is, if you want your little girl safe, you don't want her in a tunnel with a guy firing a gun who doesn't know what he's doing."
As if in punctuation, Amos slid the gun together. The metal clacked.
"I'll be fine," Prax said, but his legs were trembling just standing up. Amos held up the gun.
"This ready to fire?"
Amos asked. "Sorry?"
"If you pick this gun up right now, point it at a bad guy, pull the trigger, does it go bang? You just watch me put it together. Dangerous or safe?"
Prax opened his mouth, then closed it. An ache just behind his sternum grew a notch worse. Amos started to put the gun down.
"Safe," Prax said.
"You sure about that, Doc?"
"You didn't put any bullets in it. It's safe."
"You sure?"
"Yes."
Amos frowned at the gun.
"Well, yeah, that's right," he said. "But you're still not going."
Voices came from the narrow hallway from the airlock. Jim Holden's voice wasn't what Prax had thought it would be. He'd expected him to be serious, grave. Instead, even during the times like now, when the distress clipped his vowels short and tightened his voice, there was a lightness to him. The woman's voice, Naomi, not Cassandra, wasn't deeper, but it was darker.
"Those are the numbers," she said.
"They're wrong," Holden said, ducking into the mess. "They've got to be wrong. It doesn't make sense." "What's the word, Captain?"
Amos asked.
"Security's not going to be any use," Holden said. "The locals are stretched too thin, trying to keep the place from straight-out catastrophe."
"Which is why maybe we shouldn't be going in with guns drawn," Naomi said.
"Please, can we not have that conversation again right now?"
Her mouth hardened, and Amos pointedly looked at the gun, polishing the parts that already shone. Prax had the sense of walking in on a much longer conversation.
"This guy who grabs a gun first and talks later," Naomi said. "You didn't used to be him. You aren't him."
"Well, I need to be him today," Holden said in a voice that closed the subject.
The silence was uncomfortable.
"What's wrong with the numbers?" Prax asked.
Holden looked at him, confused.
"You said there was something wrong with the numbers."
"They're saying that the death rate's going up. But that's got to be wrong. The fighting was, what, one day? Day and a half? Why would things be getting worse now?"
"No," Prax said. "That's right. It's the cascade. It'll get worse."
"What's the cascade?" Naomi asked. Amos slid the pistol into its box and hauled out a longer case, a shotgun maybe. His gaze was on Prax, waiting.
"It's the basic obstacle of artificial ecosystems. In a normal evolutionary environment, there's enough diversity to cushion the system when something catastrophic happens. That's nature. Catastrophic things happen all the time. But nothing we can build has the depth.
One thing goes wrong, and there's only a few compensatory pathways that can step in. They get overstressed, fall out of balance. When the next one fails, there are even fewer paths, and then they're more stressed. It's a simple, complex system. That's the technical name for it. Because it's simple, it's prone to cascades, and because it's complex, you can't predict what's going to fail, or how. It's computationally impossible. Holden leaned against the wall, his arms folded. It was still odd seeing him in person. He looked the same as he had on the screens, and he also didn't. "Ganymede Station," Holden said, "is the most important food supply and agricultural center outside Earth and Mars. It can't just collapse. They wouldn't let it. People come here to have their babies, for God's sake." Prax tilted his head. A day before, he wouldn't have been able to explain this. For one thing, he wouldn't have had the blood sugar to fuel thought. For another, he wouldn't have had anyone to say it to. It was good to be able to think again, even if it was only so he could explain how bad things had become. "Ganymede's dead," Prax said. "The tunnels will probably survive, but the environmental and social structures are already broken. Even if we could somehow get the environmental systems back in place, and really we can't without a lot of work, how many people are going to stay here now? How many would be going to jail? Something's going to fill the niche, but it won't be what was here before."
"Because of the cascade," Holden said.
"Yes," Prax said. "That's what I was trying to say before, to Amos. It's all going to fall apart. The relief effort's going to make the fall a little more graceful, maybe. But it's too late. It's too late. And since May's out there and we don't know what's going to break, I have to go with you."
"Prax," Cassandra said. "No, Naomi." Maybe his brain wasn't really up to full power even now.
"Strickland and that woman, even if they think they can keep her safe, they can't, you see? Even if they're not hurting her, even if they're not, everything around them is going to fall apart. What if they run out of air? What if they don't understand what's happening?"
"I know this is hard," Holden said, "but shouting about it won't help."
"I'm not shouting. I'm not shouting. I'm just telling you that they took my little girl away and I need to go and get her. I need to be there when you open that door. Even if she's not there, even if she's dead, I need to be the one who finds her."
The sound was crisp and professional and oddly beautiful. A magazine slipping into a pistol. Prax hadn't seen Amos take it back out of its box, but the dark metal was in the man's huge hand, dwarfed by his fingers. While he watched, Amos chambered a round. Then he took the gun by its barrel, careful to keep it pointing at the wall, and held it out.
"But I thought," Prax said,
"you said I wasn't."
Amos stretched his arms out another half inch. The gesture was unmistakable.
"Take it."
Prax took it. It was heavier than it looked.
Amos? Holden said. "Did you just give him a loaded gun?"
"Doc needs to go, Captain," Amos said with a shrug. "So I'm thinking he should probably go."
Prax saw the look that passed between Holden and Naomi. "We might want to talk about that decision-making process, Amos," Naomi said, shaping the words carefully.
"You betcha," Amos said. "Soon as we get back."
Prax had been walking through the station for weeks as a native, a local, a refugee with nowhere to flee. He'd gotten used to how the hallways looked, how people's eyes slid over him in case he'd try to lay his burdens on them. Now that Prax was fed and armed and part of a group, the station had become a different place. People's eyes still slid across them, but the fear was different, and hunger
fought against it. Holden and Amos didn't have the gray of malnutrition or the haunted look around their eyes of seeing everything they thought was immutable collapse. Naomi was back at the ship, hacked into the local security network and ready to coordinate the three of them in case they got split up. For the first time, perhaps in his life, Prax felt like an outsider. He looked at his hometown and saw what Holden would see. A huge hallway, with paints and dyes worked into the ice up high on the wall. The lower half, where people might accidentally touch it, covered in thick insulation. Ganymede's raw ice would strip the flesh from bone with even the briefest contact. The hallway was too dark now, the floodlights beginning to fail. A wide corridor Prax had walked through every day he was at school was a dim chamber filled with the sounds of dripping water as the climate regulation failed. The plants that weren't dead were dying, and the air was getting the stale taste at the back of his throat that meant the emergency recyclers would be coming on soon. Should be coming on soon. Had better. Holden was right, though. The thin-faced, desperate people they passed had been food scientists and soil technicians, gas exchange experts, and agricultural support staff. If Ganymede Station died, the cascade wouldn't stop here. Once the last load of food lifted off, the belt, the Jovian system, and the myriad long-term bases in their own orbits around the sun would have to find a different way to get vitamins and micronutrients for their kids. Prax started wondering whether the bases on the far planets would be able to sustain themselves. If they had full hydroponics rigs and yeast farms and nothing went wrong, it was a distraction. It was grasping anything other than the fear of what would be waiting behind that door. He embraced it.
"Hold up, Oyo."
The voice was low and rough and wet, like the man's vocal cords had been taken out and dragged through mud. He stood in the center of the ice tunnels intersecting before them. Military police body armor, two sizes too small, straining to keep his bulk in. His accent and build said he was Martian. Amos and Holden paused, turned, looking everywhere but at the man before them. Prax followed their gazes. Other men lurked, half hidden around them. The sudden panic tasted like copper.
"I make six," Holden said.
"What about the guy with the gray pants?" Amos asked.
"Okay, maybe seven. He's been with us since we left the ship, though. He might be something else."
"Six is still more than three," Naomi said in their ears. "You want me to send backup?"
"Ah, damn, we've got backup?" Amos asked. "Gonna have Super Teyuporn come down and talk them all to death?"
"We can take them," Prax said, reaching for the pistol in his pocket. "We can't let anyone..." Amos's wide hand closed over his own, keeping the gun in his pocket and out of sight.
"These aren't the ones you shoot," Amos said. "These are the ones you talk to."
Holden stepped toward the Martian. The ease with which he held himself made the assault rifle on his shoulder seem almost innocuous. Even the expensive body armor he wore didn't seem at odds with his casual smile.
"Hey," Holden said, "there a problem, sir?"
"Might be," the Martian drawled. "Might not. That's your call."
"I'll take not," Holden said. "Now, if you'll excuse us, we'll be on..."
"Slow down,"
the Martian said, sidling forward. His face was vaguely like someone Prax had seen before on the tube and never particularly remarked.
"You're not from around here."
"I am," Prax said. "I'm Dr. Praxitiki Mung, chief botanist on the RMD Southern Soy Farm Project. Who are you?"
"Let the captain do this," Amos said.
"But he's pretty good at it."
"I'm thinking you're part of the relief work,"
the Martian said.
Long way from the docks. Looks like you lost your way. Maybe you need an escort back to where it's safe.
Holden shifted his weight. The assault rifle just happened to slide forward a few inches, not at all provocatively.
I don't know, Holden said. We're pretty well protected. I think we can probably take care of ourselves.
What kind of fee are you, escorts asking? Well now, I count three of you. Call it 100 in Martian script, 5 local.
How about you follow us down, and I arrange passage for all of you off this ice ball?
The Martian's jaw dropped.
That's not funny, he said.
But the mask of power and confidence had slipped. Prax had seen the hunger and desperation behind it.
I'm going to an old tunnel system, Holden said. Someone abducted a bunch of kids right before everything went to hell. They took them there. Doc's kid was one of the ones that got snatched. We're going to get her back and politely ask how they knew all this was coming down. Might be resistance. I could use a few people who know what end of the gun points forward.
You're fucking with me, the Martian said.
From the corner of his eye, Prax saw one of the others step forward, a thin woman in cheap protective weave.
We're OPA, Amos said, then nodded at Holden. He's James Holden of the Rocinante. Holy shit, the Martian said. You are. You're Holden.
It's the beard, Holden said.
My name's Wendell. Used to work for Pinkwater Security before the bastards took off, left us here. Way I figure, that voids the contract. You want to pick up some professional firepower, you ain't gonna find better than us.
How many you got?
6, counting me.
Holden looked over at Amos. Prax felt Amos shrug as much as saw it. The other man they'd been talking about was unrelated after all.
All right, Holden said. We tried to talk to local security, but they didn't give us the time of day. Follow me, back us up, and I give you my word you'll get off Ganymede. Wendell grinned. He'd had one of his incisors dyed red with a small black and white design on it.
Anything you say, boss, he said, then lifting his gun. Form up. We got us a new contract, people. Let's get it done.
The whoops came from all around them. Prax found the thin woman beside him, grinning and shaking his hand like she was running for office. Prax blinked and smiled back, and Amos put his hand on Prax's shoulder.
See? Told you. Now let's get moving.
The hallway was darker than it had seemed in the video. The ice had thin melt channels, like pale veins, but the frost covering them was fresh. The door looked like any other of 100 they'd passed on the way in. Prax swallowed. His stomach ached. He wanted to scream for May, to call her name and hear her call back.
Okay, Naomi said in his ear. I've got the lock disabled. Whenever you guys are ready.
No time like the present, Holden said. Open it up.
The seal around the door hissed. The door opened. Chapter 15. Bobby. 3 hours into the first big meeting between the Martian and UN diplomats, and they'd only just got past introducing everyone and on to reading the agenda. A squat earther in a charcoal gray suit that probably cost more than Bobby's recon armor droned on about Section 14, Subsection D, Items 1 through 11, in which they would discuss the effect of past hostilities on commodity pricing pursuant to existing trade agreements. Bobby looked around, noticed that everyone else at the long oak table was staring with rapt attention at the agenda reader, and stifled the truly epic yawn that was struggling to get out. She distracted herself by trying to figure out who people were.
They'd all been introduced by name and title at some point, but that didn't mean much. Everyone here was an assistant secretary or undersecretary or director of something. There were even a few generals, but Bobby knew enough about how politics worked to know that the military people in the room would be the least important. The people with real power would be the quiet ones with unassuming titles. There were several of those, including a moon-faced man with a skinny tie who'd been introduced as the secretary of something or other. Sitting next to him was someone's grandmother in a bright sari, a splash of yellow in the middle of all the dark brown and dark blue and charcoal gray. She sat and munched pistachios and wore an enigmatic half-smile. Bobby entertained herself for a few minutes by trying to guess if Moonface or Grandma was the boss. She considered pouring a glass of water from one of the crystal decanters evenly distributed across the table. She wasn't thirsty, but turning her glass over, pouring water into it, and drinking it would burn a minute, maybe two. She glanced down the table and noticed that no one else was drinking the water. Maybe everyone was waiting for someone else to be first.
"Let's take a short break," Charcoal Suit Man said. 10 minutes, then we can move on to section 15 of the agenda.
People got up and began dispersing toward restrooms and smoking areas. Grandma carried her handbag to a recycling chute and dumped pistachio shells into it. Moonface pulled out his terminal and called someone.
"Jesus,"
Bobby said, rubbing her eyes with her palms until she saw stars.
"Problem, Sergeant?"
Thorson said, leaning back in his chair and grinning.
"The gravity wearing on you?"
"No," Bobby said. Then, "Well, yes, but mostly I'm ready to jab a stylus into my eye just for a change of pace." Thorson nodded and patted her hand, a move he was using more often now. It hadn't gotten any less irritating and paternalistic, but now Bobby was worried that it might mean Thorson was working up to hitting on her. That would be an uncomfortable moment. She pulled her hand away and leaned toward Thorson until he turned and looked her in the eye.
"Why," she whispered, "is no one talking about the goddamned monster? Isn't that why we're here?"
"You have to understand how these things work," Thorson said, turning away from her and fiddling with his terminal. "Politics moves slow, because the stakes are very high, and no one wants to be the person that screwed it up." He put his terminal down and gave her a wink. "Careers are at stake here."
"Careers."
Thorson just nodded and tapped on his terminal some more.
"Careers?"
For a moment, she was on her back, staring up into the star-filled void above Ganymede. Her men were dead or dying, her suit radio dead, her armor a frozen coffin. She saw the thing's face. Without a suit, in the radiation and hard vacuum, the red snowfall of flash-frozen blood around its claws. And no one at this table wanted to talk about it, because it might affect their careers. To hell with that. When the meeting's attendees had shuffled back into the room and taken their places around the table, Bobby raised her hand. She felt faintly ridiculous, like a fifth-grade student in a room full of adults, but she had no idea what the actual protocol for asking a question was. The agenda reader shot her one annoyed glance, then ignored her. Thorson reached under the table and sharply squeezed her leg. She kept her hand up.
"Excuse me," she said.
People around the table took turns giving her increasingly unfriendly looks and then pointedly turning away. Thorson upped the pressure on her leg until she'd had enough of him and grabbed his wrist with her other hand. She squeezed until the bones creaked, and he snatched his hand away with a surprised gasp. He turned his chair to look at her.
his eyes wide and his mouth a flat, lipless line. Yellow Sari placed a hand on the agenda reader's arm, and he instantly stopped talking.
Okay, that one is the boss, Bobby decided.
I, for one, Grandma said, smiling a mild apology at the room, would like to hear what Sergeant Draper has to say.
She remembers my name, Bobby thought. That's interesting.
Sergeant, Grandma said. Bobby, unsure of what to do, stood up. I'm just wondering why no one is talking about the monster.
Grandma's enigmatic smile returned. No one spoke. The silence slid adrenaline into Bobby's blood. She felt her legs starting to tremble. More than anything in the world, she wanted to sit down, to make them all forget her and look away. She scowled and locked her knees.
You know, Bobby said, her voice rising, but she was unable to stop it. The monster that killed 50 soldiers on Ganymede? The reason we're all here?
The room was silent. Thorson stared at her like she had lost her mind. Maybe she had.
Grandma tugged once at her yellow sari and smiled encouragement. I mean, Bobby said, holding up the agenda, I'm sure trade agreements and water rights and who gets to screw who on the second Thursday after the winter solstice is all very important.
She stopped to suck in a long breath, the gravity and her tirade seeming to have robbed her of air. She could see it in their eyes. She could see that if she just stopped now, she'd be an odd thing that happened, and everyone could go back to work and quickly forget her. She could see her career not crashing off a cliff in flames. She discovered that she didn't care.
But, she said, throwing the agenda across the table, where a surprised man in a brown suit dodged it as though its touch might infect him with whatever Bobby had, what about the fucking monster?
Before she could continue, Thorson popped up from his seat.
Excuse me for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Sergeant Draper is suffering from some post-combat related stress and needs attention.
He grabbed her elbow and drove her from the room, a rising wave of murmurs pushing at their backs. Thorson stopped in the conference room's lobby and waited for the door to shut behind him.
You,
Thorson said, shoving her toward a chair. Normally, the skinny intelligence officer couldn't have pushed her anywhere, but all the strength seemed to have run out of her legs and she collapsed into the seat.
You, he repeated.
Then, to someone on his terminal, he said, get down here, now.
You,
he said a third time, pointing at Bobby, then paced back and forth in front of her chair. A few minutes later, Captain Martins came trotting into the conference room lobby. He pulled up short when he saw Bobby slouched in her chair and Thorson's angry face.
What? He started, but Thorson cut him off.
This is your fault, he said to Martins, then spun to face Bobby. And you, Sergeant, have just proven that it was a monumental mistake to bring you along. Any benefit that might have been gained from having the only eyewitness has now been squandered by your idiotic tirade.
She, Martins tried again, but Thorson poked a finger into his chest and said,
you said you could control her.
Martins gave Thorson a sad smile. No, I never said that. I said I could help her given enough time.
Doesn't matter, Thorson said, waving a hand at them. You're both on the next ship to Mars, where you can explain yourselves to a disciplinary board. Now get out of my sight.
He spun on his heel and slipped back into the conference room, opening the door only wide enough for his narrow body to squeeze through. Martins sat down in the chair next to Bobby, and let out a long breath.
So, he said, what's up?
Did I just destroy my career? She asked.
Maybe. How do you feel?
I feel, she said, realizing how badly she did want to talk with Martins and becoming angered by the impulse. I feel like I need some air. Before Martins could protest, Bobby stood up and headed for the elevators. The UN complex was a city in its own right. Just finding a way out took her the better part of an hour. Along the way, she moved through the chaos and energy of government like a ghost. People hurried past her in the long corridors, talking energetically in clumps or on their hand terminals. Bobby had never been to Olympia, where the Martian Congressional Building was located. She'd caught a few minutes of congressional sessions on the government broadcast when an issue she cared about was being discussed, but compared to the activity here at the UN, it was pretty low-key. The people in this building complex governed 30 billion citizens and hundreds of millions of colonists. By comparison, Mars's 4 billion suddenly seemed like a backwater. On Mars, it was a generally accepted fact that Earth was a civilization in decay. Lazy, coddled citizens who lived on the government dole. Fat, corrupt politicians who enriched themselves at the expense of the colonies. A degrading infrastructure that spent close to 30% of its total output on recycling systems to keep the population from drowning in its own filth. On Mars, there was virtually no unemployment. The entire population was engaged either directly or indirectly in the greatest engineering feat in human history, the terraforming of a planet. It gave everyone a sense of purpose, a shared vision of the future. Nothing like the Earthers, who lived only for their next government payout and their next visit to the drugstore or entertainment malls. Or at least, that was the story. Suddenly, Bobby wasn't so sure. Repeated visits to the various information kiosks scattered through the complex eventually got her to an exit door. A bored guard nodded to her as she passed by, and then she was outside. Outside. Without a suit. 5 seconds later, she was clawing at the door, which she now realized was an exit only, trying to get back in. The guard took pity on her and pushed the door open. She ran back inside and collapsed on a nearby settee, gasping and hyperventilating. "First time?" the guard asked with a smile. Bobby found herself unable to speak, but nodded. "Mars or Luna?" "Mars," she said, once her breathing had slowed.
"Yeah, I knew it. Domes, you know. People who've been in domes just panic a bit. Belters lose their shit. And I mean completely. We wind up shipping them home drugged up to keep them from screaming."
"Yeah," Bobby said, happy to let the guard ramble while she collected herself.
"No kidding."
"They bring you in when it was dark outside?"
"Yeah.
They do that for off-worlders.
Helps with the agoraphobia."
"Yeah.
I'll hold the door open a bit for you, in case you need to come back in again."
The assumption that she'd give it a second try instantly won Bobby over, and she actually looked at the guard for the first time. Earther short, but with beautiful skin so dark it was almost blue. He had a compact, athletic frame and lovely gray eyes. He was smiling at her without a trace of mockery.
"Thank you," she said. "Bobby. Bobby Draper."
"Chuck," he replied. "Look at the ground, then slowly look to the horizon. Whatever you do, don't look straight up."
"I think I got it this time, Chuck, but thanks."
Chuck gave her uniform a quick glance and said,
"Semper Fi, Gunny."
"Oorah," Bobby replied with a grin. On her second trip outside, she did as Chuck had recommended and looked down at the ground for a few moments.
This helped reduce the feeling of massive sensory overload, but only a little. 1,000 scents hit her nose, competing for dominance. The rich aroma of plants and soil she would expect in a garden dome, the oil and hot metal from a fabrication lab, the ozone of electric motors. All of them hit her at once, layered on top of each other and mixed with scents too exotic to name. And the sounds were a constant cacophony. People talking, construction machinery, electric cars, a transorbital shuttle lifting off, all at once and all the time. It was no wonder it had caused a panic. Just 2 senses worth of data threatened to overwhelm her. Add that impossibly blue sky that stretched on forever. Bobby stood outside, eyes closed, breathing until she heard Chuck let the door close behind her. Now she was committed. Turning around and asking Chuck to let her back in would be admitting defeat. He'd clearly done some time in the UNMC, and she wasn't going to look weak in front of the competition. Hell no. When her ears and nose had gotten more accustomed to the barrage of inputs, she opened her eyes again, looking down at the concrete of the walkway. Slowly, she lifted them till the horizon was in view. Ahead of her lay long sidewalks passing through meticulously tended green space. Beyond it, in the distance, was a gray wall that must have stood 10 meters high, with guard towers regularly spaced on it. The UN complex had a surprising amount of security. She wondered if she'd be able to get out. She needn't have worried. As she approached the guarded gate to the outside world, the security system queried her terminal, which assured it of her VIP status. A camera above the guard post scanned her face, compared it to the picture on file, and verified her identity while she was still 20 meters from the gate. When she reached the exit, the guard snapped her a sharp salute and asked if she'd need a ride. "No, just going for a walk," she said. The guard smiled and wished her a good day. She began walking down the street leading away from the UN complex, then turned around to see 2 armed security personnel following her at a discreet distance. She shrugged and walked on. Somebody would probably lose their job if a VIP like her got lost or hurt. Once Bobby was outside the UN compound, her agoraphobia lessened. Buildings rose around her like walls of steel and glass, moving the dizzying skyline far enough up that she no longer saw it. Small electric cars whizzed down the streets, trailing a high-pitched whine and the scent of ozone. And people were everywhere. Bobby had gone to a couple of games at Armstrong Stadium on Mars to watch the Red Devils play. The stadium had seats for 20,000 fans. Because the Devils were usually at the bottom of the standings, it generally held less than half that. That relatively modest number was the greatest number of humans Bobby had ever seen in one place at one time. There were billions of people on Mars, but there weren't a lot of open spaces for them to gather. Standing at an intersection, looking down 2 streets that seemed to stretch into infinity, Bobby was sure she saw more than the average attendance of a Red Devils game just walking on the sidewalks. She tried to imagine how many people were in the buildings that rose to vertigo-inducing heights in every direction around her, and couldn't. Millions of people, probably in just the buildings and streets she could see. And if Martian propaganda was right, most of the people she could see right now didn't have jobs. She tried to imagine that, not having any particular place you had to be on any given day. What the Earthers had discovered is that when people have nothing else to do, they have babies.
For a brief period in the 20th and 21st centuries, the population had looked like it might shrink rather than continue to grow. As more and more women went into higher education, and from there to jobs, the average family size grew smaller. A few decades of massive employment shrinkage